morning. Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology for February 26, 2016 is meeting now. And we've got a full agenda. We need to get moving. So would you give us the first thing we're working on?
Certainly, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee. The first item up is a work session for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. If you could begin to come up as I read the introduction.
So before you start, I'm going to open a work session on the Department of Geology and Mineral Information Industries IT Assessment Report and Budget Note. Go ahead.
Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, during the 2015 legislative session, the legislature adopted and attached a budget note to the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries budget bill, Senate Bill 5512. The budget note directed DOGAMI to work with the Office of the State Chief Information Officer to conduct a comprehensive assessment of the agency's information technology-related operations. A report on this comprehensive assessment was submitted as required to the Legislative Fiscal Office. DOGAMI and the Office of the State CIO jointly presented the assessment report as required to the Natural Resources Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means earlier this week and are here this morning to present a report on the assessment to the JLCIMT. Thank you all for coming. If you could introduce yourself for the record before you begin presenting.
Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brad Avey, Director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. I'll be presenting DOGAMI's response following the Office of the State CIO's presentation of the IT assessment.
And I'm Alex Pettit. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the State of Oregon. So we'll just jump right into it here. For those of you that I'm not going to read through all these things verbatim, the DOGAMI was established in 1937, comprised of two programs, the Geological Survey and Services Program and the Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation Program. Over the years, their budget has, as you see, it's really, I want to draw your attention to the general fund contribution to the budget that has ebbed and flowed over the years. One of the challenges that DOGAMI has faced is in establishing a base level of services or base level of functionality, I should say, that is to act as a support or a platform for the project-based work that they do in support of the federal funds and other funds that they receive. So there's a fundamental level of services that need to be provided, and that's really what we're talking about in part here today. There was a budget note. The department was directed to work with OSCIO to conduct a comprehensive assessment of org structure, inventory of systems, business drivers, operational and technical deficiencies, current and potential alternatives, technical requirements, and any requirements necessary or recommended changes or enhancement to management, staffing, funding policies, and practices. So a multidisciplinary team from my office and GEO was put together to look at the business drivers, the inventory of IT policies, the analysis of the core business processes, how well IT is used within those processes. So this is our report. One of DOGAMI's core missions is the collection, analysis, and processing of very large quantities of geospatial and geological information. The agency's primary challenge is to afford to maintain the massive storage and data transfer capacities that their mission requires. So there were three primary areas of concern: the lack of dedicated IT management, lack of understanding of how to operate and comply with state procurement and purchasing policy, and an overburdened staff trying to support the entire stack of IT operations in-house. Although DOGAMI has 11 employees as information services specialists, the agency actually has no dedicated IT staff. That was a HR categorization error, if you like. Staff augmentation, primary IT functions are performed by a contractor. Without IT staff, the agency struggles to develop IT planning and strategy, maintains security standards, managed data, storage systems and recovery, and network communication and information distribution. So the net of it is the staff does the best that they can, and they do what has to be done within the constraints of what they have, and they work very hard to do it. But it is a fundamental challenge that they have to meet those, to be able to make technology something that helps them to deliver on their mission. So one of the critical needs that was identified was storage. Right now, at the rate that Dogami is running at, they'll run out of storage sometime in 2017. Cannot afford to build and support more in the current infrastructure. They're at a technological dead end on the infrastructure, on the architecture that they have right now. And then, as you see, projecting through 2021, there's not been a stratification of data, a deduplication of data with other agencies. So it's hoped, it's expected that these demands, as we're able to get into there and do an analysis, a deeper analysis, that the requirements will be reduced. But right now, at the run rate that we've got, this is the projection, this is the forecast. So, so our recommendations come in two groupings, you know, short term and long term. Short term recommendations are to work with OSCIO on some tactical plans. Mitigate urgent IT infrastructure issues, evaluate migrating non-core IT services to ETS. Dogami staff to work with DAS procurement on process and procedure for IT contracting and purchasing, and the review and implement current IT support contracts, supplement if possible to add additional resources. So using stuff that we've already got set up to help bring to bear with some of the needs they have. Long term, we'd like to work with Dogami on developing IT strategic resource plan, work with Chief Financial Officer's office to develop a policy option package to implement IT strategy. In its role as the lead of the Oregon LIDAR Consortium, should work on sustainability plans and budget to support the program's future data storage, processing, and distribution needs. Looking at externalizing IT services that are not part of the agency's core, and then implementing a technology architecture what will enable a stratified data storage, support long-term business needs, and leverage industry best practices. So
I'll turn it over here. Dogami appreciates the IT assessment just described and the work that went into it, and is very concerned about the data risks and issues identified. We're currently working with Enterprise Technology Solutions to resolve the most pressing data risks through offsite backup and recovery, and are in discussions about transferring to ETS non-core operations. We're also working with ETS to obtain strategic IT guidance to address long-term solutions and staffing needs. As mentioned, our staff are incredibly dedicated and creative in finding ways to accomplish their work with limited resources. However, to help resolve the issues identified today, Dogami anticipates approaching the emergency board in May to request funding and additional limitation. Finally, Dogami is committed to a strong partnership with the staff of ETS and the Office of the State CIO as we work towards a solution to bring Dogami's IT systems up to standard.
So, and again, it's very important to know, you know, I get a little off track with this a bit, but what's important to know is how pressed staff has been, Dogami staff has been, to find and to meet the needs of the agency. And one of the slides that's in there in your deck, it's in the appendix there, is some of those solutions. So one of those solutions was with a cooling system there, you know, to catch the condensation. You know, there's a barrel that they use that's there, and it catches the condensation, and then they roll the barrel out and they empty it on a weekly basis, and then they bring it back. And it's because when you don't have the resources to do it right, you do with what you have. You're as creative as you can be, and you get the mission done with the tools you got. And that's effectively what I hope that you take from this, is that with the tools that they've been given, they've been able to accomplish their mission. But this is something that should not have been something that handicaps them. Technology should not be something that gets in the way of achievement of mission. That's really my point. And so that was the purpose of the discussion. That's really the purpose of this presentation, and we'll sit for questions if you all have any, please.
Just a quick comment, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Mr. Pettit, I really appreciate all the work you're doing, but every time you come in front of a committee I sit on, which is a lot because of all the stuff, those things that I do, I get more and more dismayed by what I learn about the current state of our IT and more glad that you're here. So thank you for the work that you and your team are doing to help Oregon finally enter the 21st century with our IT systems, and for doing it in such a thorough, controlled, thoughtful way. And I look forward to continuing to work with you on a range of these projects.
Thank you.
So that's a lot of data. I think I have more data than most agencies of my own, and this is an incredible amount of data. we have to store it, and we also have to have at least one backup site. And so how much is it going to cost us just for the data storage?
Chairman Riley, the data storage, right now one of the things that we need to figure out is, so there's online, nearline, and offline storage. So you have to stratify some of what you have. And some of this information is also retained by other agencies. There is some of the LIDAR data, some of the other data we did find was being that other agencies also have that and host that as well. A deduplication effort needs to be done, assessment. And so right off the cuff, I can't give you that answer. I can tell you on the run rate we've got now, we're going to address it in the short run. That's what we're going to bring back in May. In the long run, our hope is that what you see, this 293 tera, we're hoping that will be significantly reduced as we go through and we stratify the data and the storage structure. So if we were to run it what we're doing now, I mean, basically we'd almost triple, as you can see, so the assumption would be we'd triple the cost.
Right.
We're at the point, though, even on the architecture, that we can't support any more of that kind of online structure. So we have to change how we're doing it. We just don't have a choice.
So. Representative Nearman?
Thank you, Chair Riley. So one little question. When you say non-core IT needs, what do you mean by that?
Chairman Riley, members of the committee, Representative Nearman, what I mean are things, there's some things that Dogami does that are core, because what they do is the development, the availability of data. There's some IT things that they do that are absolutely, just to even do their mission, that they have to perform those activities. So those things are core, those IT activities are core to what they do. There are some things that are done, that are being done, like the barrel back there, that aren't core. You know, I mean, they have to be done as part of, you know, the thing, but they don't have to, they shouldn't be worrying about that kind of thing. So taking that infrastructure out, relocating it to ETS where we have the cooling, where we have the, then that relieves somebody of a burden, and I know it's a little gross, but somebody of a burden of having to take the barrel outside and empty it, right? So, you know, those are the things. And there are other things that are just basic care and feeding sorts of things that, you know, the availability of the system, the backup of the data, the bandwidth requirements, being able to spike the bandwidth requirements. Those are things that really Dogami and Dogami personnel shouldn't have to fuss with. Their mission is and continues to be on providing the data and collecting the data and providing the data. And there's a GIS, there's an IT component to that work. That should be all that they should need to do. They shouldn't be having to fuss around with hygienic stuff. So that's really what I meant, you know.
So you'll be back in May to tell us what the plan is.
A better plan, more to it. But as you can see, we've started. Yes, sir. So
can I ask one more question?
Yes,
so
sir.
The dog that kind of doesn't bark, I'm not seeing it explicitly, is that it seems like the solution that's assumed is that you're going to move out of PSU into ETS. Is that possible, or is that kind of right? Is that the direction that you're probably going? Or you're not wanting to maybe come to a conclusion before you've done the study, but that seems like what,
yeah,
that would solve your security issue, that would solve the cooling issues.
So as you can see, part of the, so some of the security is, so these are partitions here that are on rollers. So there's really no good delineation between their server room and then the regular office space. So it's just, they're just partitions on rollers. And then the, and again, there's, without, so our anticipation is that, you know, the state has a facility that, you know, the state has the data center. The data center is right now half or less used, and it's actually, the footprint's getting smaller. So I've got a lot of raised floor space, or we have a lot of raised floor space that we can just move something into. Our goal is to use the state's assets first to the fullest extent possible, and then to be able to turn this space over to be repurposed for staff or for other things and get it out of there would be our hope, our expectation. We have to do traffic studies, and we'll have to look at the architecture. I think one of my slides that's in here is a architectural slide where we've got, you know, our current state, our as-built state of the you know, in the Portland State Office Building, and then what we're proposing as a best practice. So, you know, we've gone through and done some assessments on, okay, so this is what we would leave behind, and this is what would be in a data center, either the states or somewhere else, and this is how it would be made available to the public or to Dogami's customers. And so we've begun shaping some of that solution now, and that's in the appendix there. We've not landed 100% on it. It was Representative Parrish who was asking me about this in the previous presentation. We've not said for certain this is where we're going to go, but right now all the signs point to it would be we could get it done more quickly, more cost effectively, and potentially a more it's more sustainable for us if we were to look at using resources the state currently has, sir.
Thanks.
Are there questions? If not, would staff read the recommendation?
Certainly, Chair Riley, members of the committee, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that the JLCIMT acknowledge receipt of this report. Further, LFO recommends that the agency continue to work closely with and regularly provide progress status reports to the Office of the State CIO, the DAS Chief Financial Office, and the Legislative Fiscal Office. That the agency partner with the Office of the State CIO to jointly develop and present the Dogami Tactical IT Remediation Plan to the JLCIMT and the Emergency Board during the May 2016 legislative days, including any requests for additional resources to carry out the plan. And finally, that the agency develop and present a plan and supporting 2017-19 budget requests to the Office of the State CIO, the Governor, and the Legislature for implementing these long-term recommendations as part of the 2017-19 biennial budget development process.
Mr. Chair, that was a lot of words. Can I just summarize by saying I move acknowledging receipt of the report and the LFO recommendations?
Representative Nathanson moves that we accept the presentation and the recommendation of LFO. Any discussion? Any objection? They're adopted. And I'm going to close this work session, and I'm going to open a two-part public hearing. I'm going to open a public
information.
I'm sorry, an informational meeting, not a public hearing, an informational meeting by the Department of Revenue on the Property Valuation System Project and the geospatial data sharing among public bodies, both of those topics. And I'm going to open that informational session. So if the Department of Revenue would come up and...
And while the Department of Revenue, Chair Riley, members of the committee, while the Department of Revenue is coming up, the purpose of the Department of Revenue Property Valuation System project is to plan, acquire, and implement a commercially available off-the-shelf computer-assisted mass appraisal system. During the 2015 legislative session, the IT subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means recommended incremental conditional approval of the project. One of those conditions directed the agency to report back to the legislature on project status during the 2016 session or to interim legislative committees as required. The Department of Revenue is here this morning to provide the JLCMT with that required report. If you could introduce yourself for the record.
All right. Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Gary Humphrey. I'm the acting administrator for the Property Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. And I have with me today Bronson Rueda, who is our section manager for the valuation section, which is the area that will be using this system the most for valuing properties for us. So, as the staff indicated, per the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendation and the committee request last session, we're here today to give you an update on the property valuation system project at the department. Just to give you a quick overview, and then we'll go through the slides. But we're following the state CIO and Legislative Fiscal Office stage gate process that's been set up for state projects. We have some things we have on board now. We do have a project director assigned. We have a business analyst from within the department that's working with us on the project. We have a steering committee, a project charter. We've refined the business case, and we're ready to add a project manager and quality assurance vendor is kind of where we're at right now. We do have stage gate one approval, and we continue to work on getting the documents ready for stage gate two. We've been working with the state CIO's office, the legislative fiscal office, and our own leadership group from the project, our big project that's going on at the department, the core system replacement. We've been working with them for guidance on how to approach this project and to be successful. So we're taking all the necessary steps or that we can see to help the project run smoothly and to be successful. So Bronson is going to actually take us through a little slide deck presentation on a little more information on where we're at.
Good morning. My name is Bronson Rueda with the Department of Revenue and the Section Manager for Valuation, Senator Riley Committee. I'm going to go through the slide deck. And what it is I'm going to give a little bit of a background, introduce the project overview and the scope that you should have seen last session, the timeline, funding situation, and the current status of the project. So the valuation section, which I manage, values all the state appraised industrial property and the centrally assessed property in the state of Oregon. And once we send those values to the county then collects the property taxes. And that is a total of $50 billion, a little over $50 billion in real market value. And the county collects approximately $600 million each year in taxes. And those taxes help support education, public safety, and local government. Last session, we requested that we replace our antiquated and out-of-date computer system. It's a combination of applications and separate systems, and we want to combine that into one system going forward. And we were approved to go forward with that through bond financing in 2015. So in a nutshell, we're trying to consolidate our systems into a modern platform to sustain our ability to generate values to carry our business into the future. And we hope to achieve that by obtaining a COTS solution. And what COTS stand for, as Gary indicated, is commercial off the shelf. And what we hope to have through a COTS system is, as I mentioned, integrate all our appraisal functions into one system. We want the ability to e-communicate with our taxpayers and our counties. And what that means is data sharing. Right now we don't have that ability to transfer data back and forth. We want the ability to analyze our data. We're very paper-centric right now, and most modern appraisal systems have the ability to pull out data to analyze, and analyzing that data helps support the values that we produce. And so a cost system will help us pull out data easily. As I mentioned before, we want to get rid of our paper-centric environment and move towards an e-environment, and we want a stable platform going into the future. Right now, we have one IT person who has historical knowledge of our system, and with a new cost solution, we'll have multiple IT personnel available to assist us and also the vendor going forward. Again, we want to combine our systems to provide a better service to counties and taxpayers. And With appraisal, how we'll do that is we'll gain CAMA software. And what CAMA stands for is computer-assisted mass appraisal. And in the appraisal world, COTS and CAMA typically go hand-in-hand. So we're looking at a commercial off-the-shelf computer-assisted mass appraisal software system. And that will, again, help us consolidate all our applications into one project. What you're looking at now is our schedule or timeline. And I want to point out the first time period is winter 2015. That's really the winter of 2015-16. And I'm happy to report, proud to report, that we have passed through stage gate one. And we've dotted all our I's, crossed all our T's, and worked with DAS. And they've approved us going forward. And then at the end of our timeline, I want to point out that we have a go-live date of fall of 2017. And that is the same timeline of go-live that we reported last session. However, I do want to point out also, compared to the timeline we presented in the 2015 session, we are generally on schedule, but we are a little behind on a couple key points. And one of those is getting our project manager on board. I'll talk more about that on the next slide. And the second point I wanted to bring up is at this time we were supposed to have our RFP, or request for proposal, out the door. And what the RFP does is it gives our business requirements out to the vendors, potential vendors, for them to look what the scope of the project entails, and for them to basically tell us how much it would cost them to provide the services. And we're working on that right now. We don't have it out yet, but DAS has a schedule for us to have that RFP out and a vendor on board by September 9th of this year. And once we get that on board on September 9th, that'll be approximately 14 to 15 months until our go-live date in the fall of 2017. And with information that we have, similar projects take 11 months to 18 months to complete. And so our 14 to 15 month time frame falls within that timeline of 11 to 18 months. So we're fully confident moving forward with the knowledge we have now that we will get this done by fall of 2017. What you're looking at is our budget. The second column in is our original cost estimate. And again, this was an estimate in the initial stages of the process. And it was a total of $1.88 million that was approved through bond financing last session. The third column in is right now what we see as our anticipated cost increase. And it's, again, it is an estimate of $1.5 million. And I'll go quickly through each line item. The first one is our IT software implementation. We've learned through talking with other taxing authorities who have gone through similar projects that customization is going to be involved. So even though the term COTS, you know, commercial off the shelf, implies that perhaps you can just pull it off and plug it into your system, and that's simply not the case. There's things that we have to customize, especially tying into Measure 50. Even though the counties have a major piece of that puzzle, they put together that Measure 50 puzzle, we do have a small piece of that puzzle, and our vendors will have to help us implement that into a cost system, and that's increasing the cost. Also on this cost increase, in 2011, we had a request for information, and we had a range of potential costs for the system, and what we did is we went with the high end of the range, knowing that we do have to have some customization, and then churned that forward with inflation, and that's how we came up with that number. The second item is quality assurance. Now that we've been through stage gate one, we've learned that our quality assurance provider will need more involvement in the process, and so we've reflected that with an increased cost on that line item. The project manager cost, that has increased. We had two options to go with the project manager, two options to hire them. One is a traditional hiring method, and the next was through contracting. And we attempted to hire a project manager through the traditional hiring method, and it was unsuccessful. And so we went towards the contract method, and the costs for contracting are about 2 to 3 times more. And so we're moving along that process, and we hope to have them on board by the end of March. The last cost increase isn't an increase as so much as plugging in a number for a contingency. In the original budget, we did not have a contingency, and through more research, we found some of the projects had a contingency piece of 10 to 15% of overall project costs, and so we plugged that contingency piece in there, and that represents approximately 14% of project costs. This next slide is just a summary of everything that I just went over. Current status, Gary summarized some of this. We have two personnel on board, a project director and an IT business analyst. And we are still getting our project manager lined up. Again, that should be in March. So two of our staff have been doing the work with three people. They've been working hard, and they've got us through stage gate one, even though it is just two people. And our QA vendor should be on board within 1 to 2 months. Just to summarize, as I said before, we've made it through stage gate one. We're moving towards stage gate two. We're following the stage gate process, and things are going well, and we're moving ahead. Thank you for your time this morning. Are there any questions?
Yes, Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. So on the budget slide there, so the total cost is $3.3 million, something like that. Is that the total cost of the project, or once this goes live, are there ongoing costs that we need to anticipate?
Chair Riley, Representative Nierman, that is the cost to get the project implemented. And so going forward, there will be maintenance costs. Right now, until we get a vendor on board, we don't know what those costs are going to be.
So, can you follow?
Yes.
So that's maintenance in the sense that the laws change here and there, and there's enhancement requests, or there's bugs, or something like that. That's what you envision the maintenance costs being. There's not any kind of agreement that you anticipate where there's a annual payment or a monthly payment to some entity to keep the service going or something like that.
Chair Riley, Representative Nierman, the maintenance cost in the way I view it is probably going to be a yearly cost, and so that yearly cost will include all those things that you just described.
What can I follow again? What do you expect that to be? That yearly cost, just ballpark.
From information that we've heard, it could be anywhere from $50,000 to $150,000, but we have no idea until we get a vendor on board what that cost is going to be.
Mr. McSpaden.
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Representative Nierman, one of the things that's important to keep in mind is that in the stage gate review process, there are two stage gates that the agency has to go through. Stage gate one is very early initial planning. They just made it through that initial stage gate. At that point, the estimates are rough order of magnitude, really. When they get through the stage gate two, there's a little more refinement, there's more information. They typically have already hired a project manager, which in this case they're in the process of doing. The plans become a bit more definitive. The accurate estimates for projects, we don't anticipate being in place until stage gate three. So they still have quite a bit of detailed planning to do. We consider these estimates to be, yes, informed, but still early estimates. Detailed planning needs to occur. Generally speaking, on maintenance and support, we've found, on commercial off-the-shelf systems, the annual maintenance can be somewhere between 15% to 25% of the implementation costs, depending on the contract. So again, those details won't be known until RFP results come back and we understand which vendor solutions are available and what their maintenance structures are going to be.
Good, thanks.
Thank you for your presentation. Appreciate your being here.
Thank you.
Our next informational meeting is on geospatial data sharing among public bodies. We have a number of people here to testify. This is a topic of special interest to me. Not only am I interested in it, I'm very concerned about the preliminary information I've been hearing. After we hear from the State Geographic Information Officer, I would like to be sure that I hear the presentation from the military department before I leave to go testify in another hearing room. I'm waiting to get the word when I need to leave. But I do want to change the order because if I do have to be out of this hearing room for a little while, I want to make sure I don't miss the emergency management presentation, with apologies to those who I may miss a few minutes of information. Mr. Smith, first.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Cy Smith. I am the Geospatial Information Officer for Oregon, and I have a presentation here. And I think we were going to start with some opening remarks from Mr. Rue.
Yes, Co-Chair Nathanson, members, I'm Jim Rue, the Director of the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development. Just a couple of very quick opening comments. Geospatial data. We're talking about data linked to location that helps policymakers throughout the state, as well as implementers, make decisions on critical policy that can affect people's lives, can affect public safety, certainly natural resources, and a whole range of other issues. So obviously that data be accurate and timely and available to all levels of government, whether it's local, state, or federal, and that they are integrated among those three levels is absolutely essential. There are sister agencies of ours throughout the state of Oregon who use geospatial data on a daily basis. But often it is not integrated, that often those agencies don't work with each other and share their data. And so that's really what we're here to talk to you about this morning, is a model that shares the data among and between agencies and local governments. Very simply, we're starting the process of doing an inventory of agency capacity and agency needs, so two columns, if you will, and then we're going to start going through the process of crossing and matching needs with capacity, regardless of the agency, regardless of where people sit. So we're talking about moving electrons and not people, but we are talking about breaking down some of the silos between agencies. Senator Hayward, like you, I learn something every time Alex Pettit opens his mouth. I just learned the word deduplication. But whether that's in Oxford English or not.
In the library world, we shorten it to deduping.
Deduping, thank you.
It's true.
That is a very large part of what we're talking about here, is efficiency of delivery to the citizens of the state of Oregon using this kind of data. So, with that.
And I would like to mention something to the committee and also to you all. We hear an awful lot about redundancy. We hear a lot about gaps, data sharing. We just heard that mentioned in the previous conversation. I was very troubled some years ago when I was on the city council and started getting into the topic of interoperability for emergency communications. And someone sent me a photo of the front seat of a patrol officer's car, and there were four mobile radios on the seat, because as that officer traveled across the county line or from one municipal jurisdiction to another, you couldn't talk, and there were literally four radios on the seat. And can you imagine when you're speeding down a road trying to respond to an emergency and trying to figure out which of those you need to pick up now? It's analogous, I believe.
Precisely my point.
We can't keep doing this way.
So with that, unless you have any questions of me, we'll go to Cy's presentation.
Thank you.
So, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I want to talk a little bit about why data sharing is important from a geospatial standpoint and really kind of define what it is that we're talking about. And, you know, the example that you gave, Chair Nathanson, is a really good one, very analogous to what we're talking about here. Fixing that problem takes some investment, but not fixing the problem requires a lot more expense over a lot longer time. So it really is important to try to fix these problems. Why geospatial data sharing is important? We spend across Oregon at all government levels large sums of money collecting, managing, maintaining, and using geospatial data for all sorts of reasons. Nearly everything that government does is related to a location. It happens somewhere. It's we track it. We keep track of information about that place, about the events that happened there, and so on. A sizable and costly portion of the needed data is common to nearly all programs. We duplicate effort. We waste time and money and inhibit our effective service delivery by not sharing the data. Most government agencies are most government activities, sorry, are completed with multi-agency and multi-jurisdictional collaboration. So, it's the theory is that we fund agencies to do certain things, but the reality is that they have to interrelate with each other, interact with each other, and share data in order to get those jobs done. That happens all the time. People make those connections and share that data because they know each other, they figured out that they need to do it. As people move, the connections break. Framework data and data sharing, if it's done consistently, enables those connections between the silos to be persistent and not to break as easily, so we spend less money. So using a shared set of framework data would eliminate the need for a lot of duplicated effort. Framework data, this is what we're talking about. There are nationally recognized themes. We had a hearing a few weeks ago on the Next Generation 911, and we kind of talked about this a little bit. You had asked a question about the nationally recognized framework and Federal Geographic Data Committee and so on. The Federal Geographic Data Committee has established the layers on the left as nationally recognized framework themes. On the right, we've decided in Oregon that we have some other data that we believe would be part of a reference or a base set of data, and we want to share those pieces of information that don't fit into the themes or the buckets on the left side very neatly. So we established some additional themes of data that we want to share. We have a governance structure that mirrors a national governance structure and goes into a little more detail that allows us to manage the data sharing to a certain level. And we have 15 working committees representing each of those themes of data. There are about 450 people across the state at multiple levels of government and private sector that spend their time coordinating on this data sharing and coordinating on these activities, developing this kind of data as, volunteering part of their time. It operates under the auspices of the Governor's Geographic Information Council. Each of those teams is tasked with an implementation plan and a standard for each of those data themes. And that mirrors the federal standards. If there are federal standards, we adopt those typically.
Thank you. Senator Steiner here.
Really quickly, and I apologize for, I was just trying to parse through the previous slide actually, but we're going to be using this for human services related things as well, right? Not
That's
just
right.
for land use issues. Okay, because that wasn't super clear on the previous slide, and I just want to make sure, because frankly, things like hot spotting for health issues and for areas where we see a higher rate of child abuse or neglect, maybe because of poverty, can be really critical use of GIS. And I just want to be sure that that's included in this, and I just didn't say it explicitly. So cool. Thank
it
you.
Is.
Excellent.
So our biggest challenge is when you've got 450 people involved at every level of government and they're volunteering their time, communication is a big challenge, funding is a big challenge, but constraints on data sharing between government agencies is a huge challenge for us. I'm going to show you one example of one theme of data just so you understand a little bit more about what we're talking about in terms of a reference set of data. The transportation framework is a good example. You're going to hear a little bit more about data sharing with regard to transportation in a bit.
The transportation framework is basically a statewide street center line file, a road network in the computer mapping network. It's updated locally, meaning city and county public works offices provide a lot of the information for city streets and county roads. ODOT puts that together with state highways and federal resource roads and integrates it into a statewide road centerline file. And actually, Google and Bing and a number of other providers end up consuming that data in a lot of cases where they're not building their own. There's an E911 funding mechanism that helps pay for some of that. The federal gas tax helps pay for some of the development and maintenance of it, and it's coordinated with regional and national models. This is a cartoon version of what it looks like, just so you can kind of see. You've got a BLM road in the upper right in blue, connected to a county road, connected to city streets, connected to a state highway. They have numbers that correspond to each one of those segments, so we can keep track of them, and data can be tied to those segments, like whether the road has, when it was last maintained, what the construction is, who owns it, etc. That's an example of a framework theme, and there are 14 other themes like that. Tax lots is one of those themes. Department of Revenue manages that one. Managing a shared resource in terms of communications, policies and standards, etc., is very difficult. That's why we have a governance structure, to help us manage this data that's shared. There's nobody who has responsibility for all of that data, no single organization, so we have to have a governance structure where we can all make decisions about how the data is managed and shared.
So one of you, if one of you does something, it's not going to goof up the other person's ability to use it.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And the stakeholders grant that governance structure its authority. There isn't any other authority necessarily that that would work across all the levels of government, including federal agencies, private sector, et cetera. Two examples of use of the framework data that cut across agency boundaries. There was a fire, there are wildfires every year. This one was particularly interesting. It was it was the Sheldon Ridge fire. It was near the Dalles. They happened to have some really good data there that helped fight the fire at the local level. So this was the fire perimeter on July 26th. It started on July 24th. It was 200 acres. Overnight, it blew up to 6,000 acres, and within that perimeter, all these little yellow dots are address points where they had houses, most of them with long driveways and gates that had to be, where the gate had to be cut open. The local government had these address points. They knew where all these houses were exactly. In order to fight this fire, because it blew up so quickly, they had to bring in people from Portland, firefighters from Portland, the Portland area. They had federal firefighters, state firefighters there. Those people didn't know where all this stuff was. So having this data and being able to share it quickly in a response center was very, very important. They didn't lose any houses or any lives in this fire because they had that data. We don't have that data everywhere in the state, and we don't share it with each other everywhere in the state. So if this fire had happened 50 miles to the south in 2002, it would have been completely different. And in fact, if it happened 50 miles to the south today, it would be completely different because we still don't have the address points in that county.
You would think it would be in their interest to make it easy to share the data.
You would think so. I agree. This is an example from the social services arena. Schools and marijuana dispensaries. You've got the Department of Education, DHS, OHA, and Ag, of course, is involved in this. OLCC is involved in this. And the Employment Department in terms of businesses. And Business Oregon is actually involved in this as well. But you have to, in this particular case, you have to define a 1,000-foot perimeter around the school. So this one is around Bend. The green dots or the green circles are a 1,000-foot perimeter around existing dispensaries. The purple ones are the schools, and you zoom in, you can actually see the buildings. The 1,000-foot perimeter has to be from the building, not from the center point of the school. So you can have some bigger dots, but the idea is, of course, you have to have you can't have a dispensary within 1,000 feet of a school. So this is one of the other instances where you have to share data between agencies. These are just a list of a number of the issues that come into play in terms of trying to share data between government agencies. The ones on the left are have been very difficult to get through, but all of them are problematic.
We've tried a number of different things. We've tried model policies that were generic, that had overriding principles that conformed to public records law. That didn't work. We've tried intergovernmental agreements where we listed all the data to be shared, and you're going to hear about some of the other intergovernmental agreement things that we've tried from a public safety standpoint, from transportation. We've done the same thing with tax lots, trying it on individual data sets as well as with a list of all data, and including sharing it via the web, state agencies, et cetera.
Madam Chair, really quick question. One of the things that occurs to me based on some work that I've been trying to do that involves multiple agencies and trying to get data has been some of the agencies' concerns about limitations placed on them by federal regulations. How much are you running into that as an issue with data sharing between agencies?
Chair Nathanson, representatives, or Senator, sorry, Steinward Hayward, we have not run into that much. There actually are ways that we found that state agencies can share the data, and even local governments can share the data that has federal restrictions as long as they sign agreements. And that's really what we're talking about here is public bodies sharing the data, not making it publicly accessible.
Understood.
Right. So on fire, for example, we've managed to get all of the county assessors to share tax lots for the purposes specifically of fighting fires, and it's available to firefighting agencies. So that's been one success that we've had around one piece of data.
Okay.
But there were federal restrictions on sharing the data. So we've been able to say to the federal agencies, you can't share that data any further. You can't redistribute it, which has been another important point. So we've also had intergovernmental agreements, as I mentioned, around individual data sets with multiple options in terms of sharing it via the web, with state agencies, and so on.
And we have a comment.
If you could go back to the last slide, Mr. Smith.
This one or the one before?
This one right here. Just wanted to make a point about intergovernmental agreements and just simply the sheer size of the potential group of partners. We, as you know, have potentially over 100 state agencies. We have at the local government level 242 incorporated cities, 36 counties. At the school level, 197 school districts. When you look at the number of road authorities, there are perhaps 300 or more address authorities, perhaps 300 or more, and special districts, I believe, is over 900. So there's just the sheer size of number of entities makes the prospect of having intergovernmental agreements with each one of those entities for perhaps multiple data sets very problematic. Just wanted to
and with each that. One to have one with the other, I can't do the calculation in my head, but someone's going to be asking us for money to have now some sort of a new database and server just to manage the several hundred thousand intergovernmental agreements.
That's correct. It would be a very, very difficult problem, and that's kind of what we started to run into. In fact, just signing it with county governments, every county attorney had their own changes that they needed to make to the language, and so it just became really difficult, even with 36 counties.
Madam Chair,
yes.
One other question. You know, it occurs to me that something that I do in a total or did in a totally different part of my life might be useful to you. Back in the day, I was co-chair of the Institutional Review Board at OHSU, which is the body that looks at research studies to protect people who are participating in those studies. Often there are multi-site studies, right? OHSU, University of Massachusetts, Johns Hopkins, pick four big universities. And they end up with these consent forms are the biggest problems, going back and forth and back and forth. And one university wants you to make the investigators to make a change. Anyway, there is in the human subjects protection world the opportunity to delegate oversight to the home institution where the lead researcher is, as opposed to the satellite sites. And I'm hoping that that's part of what you're trying to do to prevent some of this, however many, you know, even just down the county level, 36 different counties each needing to make four or five changes. And I think one of the models to consider, you know, the Department of Revenue, who was up here earlier, has been doing this huge core system replacement, and they're making the point, as is the Department of Human Services with their big replacement, that they're adapting their business practices to meet the software rather than adapting the software to meet their existing business practices. And I think there's some wisdom in that, and I think there's something to be learned about trying to figure out what a really, really good solution for all involved is, rather than having the perfect solution for each one, which is a little different. And I would just encourage even more of that, and to anybody listening out there, but I honestly think that people have to focus on the benefits of getting to yes faster rather than worrying about every single possible eventuality and changing which T and I get crossed and dotted. That's more of a rhetorical comment, you know, or a comment than a question, but I don't know how much of that standardization or delegation of authority is happening in what you're trying to do with these IGAs.
If I may, just very quickly, Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Steiner Hayward, we within the state enterprise are going through a series of steps to try to get to what you're talking about. Probably close to 20 agencies now have been through a performance management system where we do that streamlining, where we try to lean out processes. But supplemental to that are using things like GIS to actually not only just align programs, but to get into something called enterprise architecture, so that we don't care which agency or which person is in charge of delivering the service, but that we do it based upon the needs of the community or the individual Oregonian. And so this is where we can go, and it's sort of the big picture of where we hope to go.
I'd also like to add that conclusions from just getting a preview of what this topic was going to be about and inviting the testimony is that the situation isn't ideal, but it's not the way it is because the state designed it that way. It sounds to me like the state and some other individual parties are doing what they can to try to get some collaboration, but without some additional authority or persuasive power or something, we're not going to get things to be much better, that it's going to take a special effort to do something in a more deliberative, planned way. And toward that end, I do want to be able to hear the rest of the presentation, but I have already been talking with our committee administrator about an approach where the co-chairs of this committee would take a proposal to probably to legislative leadership, I suppose, to have a work group to start to tackle this in the interim in a very deliberative way. In other words, this is great to have an informational meeting, but this would be the beginning of something, not the end of a presentation.
I agree completely.
So that would be my intent. And we've been talking about what that would be to get something going, because to just have an incomplete list of voluntary IGAs that works sort of sometimes is not the way we ought to be doing business.
I just have one or two more slides, and we'll turn it over to Oregon Emergency Management. These are the sort of the key, three of the key issues that we've run into and that we typically run into over and over and over again in trying to share information between government bodies: privacy, confidentiality, and security. And the reality is that all public bodies are subject to the same statutes about these, about privacy, confidentiality, and security. So I think we can find our way through that. Liability, we really do need to strengthen the liability protections between government bodies that are sharing data with each other. There have been some instances where that has come into play. And then costs. There
are significant costs to develop this. That's what I talked about at the beginning, that to fix the problem you were talking about with the radios, Chair Nathanson, it requires a significant investment, but there's a lot more money spent not making that investment than there is fixing the problem to begin with. And oh, I'm hitting the wrong button. No. Well, maybe that's the last slide. Usually it goes black when I'm done, so I wasn't sure. I think I'm finished. Any further questions?
I actually have one quick one, if I may, Madam Chair. The last point you made is the cost. If you could talk a little bit about the cost being slight compared to the benefits. It will be ultimately very helpful to this legislature, especially those of us like Representative Nathanson and myself, who are ways and means junkies, to understand about the cost-benefit analysis, not just in terms of human potential, but in terms of true, honest-to-goodness cost savings. The example you gave about the fire, I think, is actually a very legitimate one, because the cost that would have been incurred had homes been damaged, I'm guessing right there you made up for any costs that were incurred setting up that system. So it would be helpful if we could have some more concrete examples eventually about how that ROI plays out. I'm, as you can probably tell, totally on board with this. But I just think people need some concrete examples.
Senator Steiner-Hayward, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. In fact, that is one of the purposes of the work group. We really believe that through working with the Office of the State CIO, the Oregon Geographic Information Council, the state GIO and local governments, tribes, at all levels in this work group, the work group will necessarily need to be representative of the key players at each level of government, and we believe we can glean specific examples about duplicate investment of federal dollars, state dollars, regional, local government dollars for the same data. We have a number of preliminary examples that we've been able to put together, but that would be one of the things that this work group would bring back to this committee and to the legislature, just prior to the 17th session.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, if I could just say one quick thing about that. There was a study done in 2012 in King County. They've had a GIS program very much like what we're trying to build here in place for 20 years. They've spent $240 million on it over that 20-year period. They measured the return on investment that they got from that program over that 20-year period. They achieved a 10-to-1 ROI. They've achieved $2.4 billion in savings from that program. They have about the same population in King County that we have in the state of Oregon. It's something, it's fairly analogous. So I think there definitely is a return on investment to be made here.
Thank you. Very cool. We're ready to move to the next.
We are. We're ready to move to Andrew Phelps from Oregon Emergency Management.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Phelps. For the record, I am the director of the Oregon Office of Emergency Management. I'd like to provide a brief overview of Oregon OEM's role in the state 911 program, of which the GIS component plays a major role. The Oregon Office of Emergency Management maintains the 911 infrastructure and backbone. That is from call origination to any one of the 43 public safety answering points, or PSAPs, here in the state of Oregon. It's our mission to ensure availability of 911 in Oregon border to border. And this program is made up of multiple components, of which GIS is one. Now, GIS in the 911 environment involves our GIS staff. This GIS staff at the OEM collects GIS data in a variety of formats from specialists in PSAPs, counties, municipalities, and vendors working in support of the PSAP community. OEM then configures GIS data received in a variety of formats to state mapping software and redistributes this information to the PSAPs. Yep.
Mr. Phelps, could you explain the acronym PSAP?
Oh, sorry, Public Safety Answering Points.
Thank you.
I thought I mentioned that.
Which is?
A 911 call center, basically.
Thank you. Sorry. Thank you.
And that's an opening for me to make a little stab again. Could you remind us how many PSAPs we have in Oregon?
43.
43. And how many counties are there in Oregon? I know the answer.
36.
Thank you.
Thank you. This redistribution of the GIS data, once it's been populated into the state mapping software, really allows for GIS synchronization and coordination across the 911 enterprise. The Office of Emergency Management in 2010 began entering into data sharing agreements with individual PSAPs. While these data sharing agreements are not mandatory, we believe them to be smart business practices and make sense to ensure data availability and, most importantly, interoperability. These agreements currently provide for the sharing of GIS data from OEMs perspective to the PSAP community and for OEMs use during Emergency Coordination Center or ECC activations. Some of the data that is provided via these agreements include road center lines, site structure address points, emergency service boundaries, and cell data sites. We certainly view a lot of opportunities in the current GIS environment. A lot of those have been covered by Mr. Smith's presentation, but certainly the development of a comprehensive umbrella approach to data sharing, ownership, and use would be much more efficient than maintaining numerous individual agreements between OEM and a variety of PSAPs, public partners, and private contractors. So that's an overview of the GIS environment at Oregon Office of Emergency Management as it relates to the public safety answering points.
So we had an example of a few minutes ago about response to a fire that increased rapidly over just a number of hours, expanded. Can you give us examples in the non-fire, a non-fire example of how GIS was used, how a good collaboration and information either was used successfully or the lack of having it impeded some sort of emergency response?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, absolutely. This past December, the state of Oregon received a pretty substantial amount of rainfall, a lot of flooding, landslides, winds, leading to a federal disaster declaration. During that activation of the state's Emergency Coordination Center, we were able to utilize data from other state partners, identified areas that were prone to landslides and flooding, areas that were in the floodplain, work with the National Weather Service to estimate anticipated rainfall, the peak river flows and flood levels, and then identify where homes or other structures were located within within perhaps a floodplain or the anticipated flood zone following those rainstorms. The inhibition or our lack of ability for us to share that information with our local first responders who really do the life-saving here in the state of Oregon, I can't point to a specific example where they didn't have access to that information through their county or through their PSAP, but certainly our ability to share that information would have been important. Related to fire, but not the firefighter response, but the firefighting recovery aspects. Out in John Day, we've been able to use this exact same information to map potential landslides or debris flows following the fires that they had this past summer and develop mitigation projects to mitigate where that water will go during runoffs of snowmelt or heavy rains. And more strategically place flood control measures to protect structures and homes and schools in John Day.
Okay, so as a preventive measure.
Correct.
Thank you.
Representative Nathanson. Mr. Phelps, perhaps you could talk, give one additional example about how GIS is used in partnership with FEMA and the recovery, the reimbursement aspects.
Absolutely. It's a combination of GIS data and also census data. But when we request a federal disaster declaration for public assistance, which is to receive federal dollars to repair or replace damaged publicly owned infrastructure, each county must meet a threshold based primarily on population. So having access to that information helps us build a stronger case when we go to FEMA and the President of the United States to ask for disaster declarations. We can't just say that we've had a bad day in Oregon, but we need to be able to tie some data and information to what was actually impacted and the number of citizens that were impacted by those events.
Good.
Representative Nathanson, members of the committee, thank you, gentlemen. The next speaker is Jerry Bohart from the Oregon Department of Transportation. And if you could please remember to introduce yourself for the record.
Certainly. Oh, it's good to see you here. I've missed hearing from you in transportation and economic development. You didn't go, I did.
Good morning, Co-Chair Nathanson, committee members. For the record, my name is Jerry Bohart. I'm the Transportation Development Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And part of my management responsibilities is the transportation data section. And included with that is our unit of GIS. And I think that Mr. Smith really, good introduction about transportation, but what I would tell you is that for our agency, geospatial is essential. We locate all of our assets, bridges, culverts, guardrails, you name it. We've really worked to make sure that all of our assets are co-located. We've actually developed what we call TransGIS, where we take various layers of information that we use for a variety of reasons. But what we actually do is we consider geospatial is really a data warehouse. So we're able to take that information and analyze it for many of the things that we do. It gives us a good look at some of our, as we go forward and looking at projects, those types of things. So we actually consider it a data warehouse. But the one thing that I really do want to talk about is our public road centerline database that really has been developed really since just the early 2000s. And as Cy mentioned, it's one of the databases that's recognized by the Geographic Information Council. We add to that crash information. We also add what we call our functional classification. So we know if it's an interstate, we know if it's a local road, or owned by another federal agency. And we really depend on this for a lot of our reporting. It's actually a 72-mile 72,000-mile database, because then we look at if whether it has two lanes, goes north or south, east or west, so if it's going two-way direction. And we have to rely on federal, and we have to rely on all of our partners in order to gain that information. Now, we typically do that right now through a variety of agreements, but it does take a lot of labor, a lot of interaction, a lot of coordination in order for that to occur. So obviously, any efficiency that we can get becomes very important. This actually is starting to become more important at the federal level. Some of the reporting that we're required to do to federal highways, in a lot of respect for funding, is now they're also looking at local roads. So they've actually developed this new acronym, which is called ARNLD, which stands for All Road Network of Linear Reference Data. So where much of our reporting, we used to be limited to the state system, we now are including the local system as well. So when we're talking about some of our certified miles, when we look at the pavement and road conditions, so that the federal level, they're also starting to get more interested in the information of the road system at the local level. So that's really kind of where we are at this point in time. So there are lots of opportunities where we can see some efficiencies working with Cy and his group. And we actually are very active in much of the work that's going on the OGIC Council. I'm a member of the council. But a lot of the data we share with folks. We actually have a data portal on our website. So any of the data that we have, we try to make available to our partners and others out there as well. So I'd be glad to answer any questions.
I do have I want to slip in the first question in case I'm called out to the other hearing room. I loved it learning the acronym, All Road Network of Linear Data.
Reference.
So when you said that and the word linear, I was getting the image of what it means to have linear data. We already have examples in communities around the state where there are roads that pass over and under each other or over and under a rail track. We don't have enough in instances of separated grade crossing, but we do have some. When I was in Tokyo, I was just amazed. There were times when there were three, possibly even four layers. How hard is it to accurately retain information and display information when you're talking about layering that way, when it's no longer just a two-dimensional situation that needs to be described.
I may turn this one over to Sai because it's sort of my area of expertise. That's why we kept Sai up there.
And one reason I'm asking is, do we have to have a new generation of software, and is it going to cost us $1 billion more to be able to handle this? But as time goes on, we're going to have to handle it.
Chair Nansen, members of the committee, it's not exactly my area of expertise either, but I do know that when you have road networks that overlay each other, one of the issues, and we can certainly manage this with existing software now, but it is one of the issues that they had to deal with in software development over the last few years, because you don't want, in order to use the network to route vehicles to get an ambulance from point A to point B, you need to have a consistent network. But where those things overlay each other, you also want to know exactly where they overlay and have a point where they overlay. You don't want that to break your network, but you need to know where that point is. So the whole idea of linear referencing becomes really important in terms of keeping track of the mile markers, but in addition, keeping track of all the points where roads meet or where they cross each other, and not having it break your network. And the software now absolutely manages that for us, but it is a very critical part of the information. And we've got to have all the data from all the different people who own all these roads to be able to put it together. And we don't really have that now. That goes back to the data sharing piece. There are road authorities and counties and cities around the state who don't want to share the road network data, just as there are counties and cities who don't want to share tax lot data, et cetera, et cetera. So we do have an issue here.
Representative Frederick.
Chair Nathanson, thank you. Why don't they want to?
Well, I don't have my slides now, but the last slide I put up really gets to a lot of it. There are three main issues. Privacy, confidentiality, security is one thing. There are multiple classes of citizens who have been exempted from the Public Records Act and public records law, judges, you know, police officers, et cetera, et cetera. Those people are in public records sharing data that has their information, could be. So it's a challenge. It's not undoable, but it's a challenge. There's liability issues if the data is not right, and another government agency that doesn't really understand the data but needs to use it doesn't know that it's not right, and they make decisions using that data. The decisions could be wrong, so there's liability that comes back to the owner of the data, and then there's the whole cost issue. It costs money to do this, and we frankly don't invest enough in it. So those are the three reasons.
Okay, let me follow up. Okay. Give me a scenario. I understand the privacy issue. You don't want to have certain folks, the judges, I understand that, police in many, many cases. But give me another scenario on how privacy is affected by road data. I'm having problems with that.
So, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Representative Frederick, I don't think privacy is probably one of the key issues with road data sharing, but liability would be absolutely an issue, and the cost would be another key issue.
I'm gonna be dumb here. Liability. How is this? What liability issues are we talking about there?
Anytime you want to.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Frederick, I think actually for the most part for the road data, we're able to all of the counties, we're able to get the information. Five counties do not allow us to share it with others, so that's where the some of the impact happens. In many cases, GIS is often viewed can be viewed by the local governments as sort of a revenue for their municipality. So it's also, so that gets a little bit to some of the costs. So they don't want to see it shared because they think they can recoup some costs depending on who the person might be. Where I think the gentleman from OEM who talked about, you asked the comment about, give me an example. So one of the key things that why having up-to-date road information for us in case of emergency is routing. detours. So understanding how we can move people from point A to point Z if part of 101 were to go down, understanding if we can, and the viability of those roads. So sometimes you can, on a map, I'm sure you've seen our state map, you can see a road, but you might not necessarily know how steep it is, what material it's made of, whether it's a dirt road or a pavement. So those are the types of information that become very invaluable for us when we deal with an emergency situation. We're able as an agency to get the road center line information. Where it becomes tricky in the work that we do, because there's some counties that don't allow us to share it, that's where we often as an agency get put into an awkward position.
I'm still mystified about what the sharing, what the problem is in terms of sharing. The detour thing makes sense. I have a bit of a map geek myself, so I happen to love to look at maps, and I you know, use Waze on the way back and forth here, and right. and do all those kinds of things. So help me a little bit on a scenario where this is actually a problem.
If I may, Chair Nathanson, Representative Frederick. There are people in this state, perhaps some in Harney and Malheur counties, who have very real concerns about data that is being collected, how it is shared, and how it is being used. And so there are counties in the state of Oregon who, for the confidentiality and security of their citizens, refuse to share that data with the state.
A couple of things that you need to, people don't know about me is, I spent a lot of time in Harney County when I was a reporter, so I know a number of the folks, and I understand some of the folks who are concerned about that. But I still struggle with, if these are private roads, I can see some of that where people are, but if we're talking about roads that are public roads that we are in fact putting money into to make sure that they continue, that's a different thing altogether. If we're not sharing that information, I don't understand why that would be the case. And I just don't understand how anyone can justify that at a county level. The county has paid for these roads, the upgrade, the maintenance, that should be available pretty easily. On private property, I understand that. That's a different thing altogether.
So, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, just to add a little bit to this, in terms of liability issues, if you the data is for road networks, in a lot of cases, is modified somewhat from the as-built survey information in order to make it fit together. Those modifications can sometimes result in errors in the data. If there is an error and it results in an ambulance not getting to the right place at the right time, if the data is not as up to date as it perhaps should be, if a piece of road has been taken out or there's some other blockage that happens and that's not included in the data because it took a while for the data to be shared and then to get to the next level and so on, there are liability issues right now that reflect back on the original provider of that data in current law. And so we just need to do more to strengthen the liability protections that are out there. That's the liability issue. The larger issue is probably around cost. It does cost a lot of money to build this electronic information and to be able to share it in a standardized way. It's one thing to build it to suit your own business purpose in the county or the city public works office, but we're asking for it to be standardized so that it can be shared with everyone in the same way. It's consistent across the state so that the lines actually do fit together, they overlay properly, and so on. And that cost is not, there's no one covering that cost very well right now. So we're asking, in some cases, for the local governments to pick up that cost, and they don't have the money to do it.
I recognize that. One quick thing. What comes to mind for me is the family that got lost down in Josephine County several years ago.
Mm-hmm. The Lee family, I think.
Right, the Lee family, right. And that trying to find them, they got lost, as I understand it, because they were using an electronic map that was wrong. And then trying to find them was also difficult because of the mapping that was wrong.
Right.
And Josephine County is struggling mightily with any sort of finances. I do understand that. But we need to find some way that we do have some standardization regarding this and the cost. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you all for the information, for your presentations, and for your very candid and helpful responses to our questions. Mr. McSpadden, could you close this topic for us?
Certainly. Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, and presenters, again, thank you very much for the great information today. It really does provide a good segue. Representative Nathanson mentioned the prospect of creating a multi-jurisdictional work group. That is something that I'll work with the co-chairs, with the legislative fiscal officer, with the state chief information officer, and others to form during the interim. Certainly we have a good stakeholder group, I think, already started with the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, with the State Assessors Association, the Land Surveyors Group, and a number of others from city and local government. We do need to do some outreach to the tribes here in Oregon and make sure we have good representation there. So that is a task that I'll take from here on. And that happens to be the last agenda item for the JLCNT today.
Good. Anything else before we adjourn? Thank you very much for your patience and your attention today. There's obviously more that we're going to hear about this topic. Thanks for being here. I am closing the informational meeting on both of those topics, and we are adjourned. Thank you. Thank you. Adjourned.